Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Dave Itzkoff is a widely respected reporter at the New York Times, where he covers film, television, theater, music, and popular culture. Currently based somewhere on the island of Manhattan, where he's earned a large following on Twitter for his sharp and comedic posts, Itzkoff has spent the last few years writing his compelling and comprehensive biography of the late multi-award-winning American comedian and actor Robin Williams. The revelatory account is called Robin, and it's out now via Henry Holt and Company. And so, Dave and I had a nice conversation recently about his interactions with Robin Williams and his friends and family, why he is so good at Twitter, why comedy is constantly under attack but also misused as a discursive shield these days, the great insight his book offers about Robin Williams' health in his final days, and much more. With in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, and Planet of Sound locations in Ottawa and Toronto, and of course, flexible monthly pledges by listeners like you at patreon.com/creativecontrol, this is the 402nd episode of Creative Control, featuring Dave Itzkoff with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me over today.
Oh, it's lovely to have you in Canadian airspace. Have you done much press in Canada for your book?
Yeah, I've talked to a few. It's strange to have to pronounce color with the word with the letter U, but I'm adapting.
Well, I want to first of all, as I often ask my guests, where in the world are you today?
I'm actually in New York in my apartment in Manhattan.
Nice, nice. And how long have you been in New York?
I lived in New York essentially my whole life. I was born here, went away for college, and then came right back as soon as it was over. So it's all that I know and all that I understand.
Right, and so you like it, clearly. You haven't left. You haven't felt oppressed by the people, by the humanity. You've stayed put.
No, my wife and I every once in a while will fantasize about what would it be like if we tried to move to Los Angeles but we've never actually taken the plunge. And now we have a 3-year-old son, so I think we're pretty much anchored here.
Well, congratulations on your family. That's great. I have a couple of kids too. We live outside of Toronto, like about an hour, and I think it's better. Like, have you ever contemplated living in a place like Connecticut? I know that's a common thing that people do.
I don't know if we could swing it. I think we'd I think we probably would find the pace a little too relaxed, and then we would just kind of drift off into oblivion. I think we need a certain amount of just agitation and frenzy in our day-to-day existence.
You clearly haven't been to certain parts of Connecticut. I think that's there. Now, I'm very happy to speak with you generally because I'm a fan of yours, and I also...
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I this book is remarkable and revelatory, this book about Robin Williams. Let's begin with how you began. How did you begin this process of writing a book about Robin Williams?
Well, I had written about Robin on a few different occasions in my capacity as a reporter for the New York Times, a few different profiles and interviews. And the longest one was around 2009 when he was going out on the road for what would become his last stand-up tour, which he called Weapons of Self-Destruction. And I had spent some time with him on that trip and at least had a kind of introduction to some people in his world. He had at one point introduced me to his son, Zach, who ended up participating in the story, but I just kind of knew peripherally. And, you know, several months after his death and as we started, just contemplating the idea of writing a book, I reached out to different people in his world, including Zach, including his managers, his publicists who I'd worked with, and just to sort of say this is an idea that we are thinking about and how would people feel, and not looking for either an explicit endorsement or a guarantee that anybody would participate, but just kind of feeling people out. And we certainly at least got the responses that were encouraging, or at least people said this is something that we would feel okay with, so that was at least a encouraging way to start. But then after that, it was about I would say a year to a year and a half of just reaching out to people, arranging interviews, looking for sources. There was a period where Robin's family was sort of enmeshed in a kind of just a legal conflict over his estate, and that prevented me from talking directly to any family members while that was going on. So talking to people in other capacities of his life, other people from earlier in his life, traveling up to Boston University where he had archived a lot of personal papers and correspondence, and then finally, getting to family members and going from there.
Now, prior to this 2009 encounter where you spend a fair amount of time with Robin, you had interviewed him before, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was the 2009 piece was really the longest, and other interviews sort of followed from that. I think the only previous interview I had done at that point was for a piece about the Bobcat Goldthwait movie, World's Greatest Dad, that Robin had starred in. And that was just like a phone interview with Robin, which was interesting. It was very, it was the first time I'd really had any kind of conversation with him. And it was so subdued and very, very low key in a way that I didn't necessarily expect him to be, just based on his work and of course how he comported himself on screen. And then I think even at that point he knew that I was going to come on the road with him. I remember him making a kind of offhand reference in that conversation to the fact that we were going to get to see each other in person. And then I went on the road with him for that tour for a few days, and there I got a lot of time with him, and in all different settings, hotel room, dressing room, on a private plane. And, he was very open about a lot of things that he had been through in up to that point in his life. The whole tour was about essentially the experience of him falling off the wagon and going into rehab to get sober from a relapse into alcoholism. About a divorce that he had just had, and also about having open heart surgery and recovering from that.
Yeah.
So the fact that was already sort of in the material of the show, he was very open just about talking about it one-on-one, really sort of difficult hardships that he had been through, and he was just so candid about all of it, which I was really surprised by.
Yeah, you've expressed surprise a couple of times in that answer, because I think we know, those of us who know Robin Williams as from afar, we think of him as this bigger-than-life, open, no-holes-barred personality, but did you seem to have discovered that he actually was a pretty private, introspective guy, right?
Yeah, I think that there were definitely parts about his life that, you know, he did not share easily or readily. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I think just from, you know, talking to, I don't know, you know, celebrities, performers, those kinds of people, they tend, you know, usually when you get an interview with them, the focus is often on whatever project they're doing, whatever they're promoting. You get to know them a little bit as a person, and then the encounter or the transaction is over. As a reporter, you often have a kind of you make an effort to try to if there's something else going on in their life that people are aware of, or some recent controversy that they've been enmeshed in, and you try to ask about that, and maybe they'll answer and maybe they won't. There's often a little bit of you know, anxiety involved in those kinds of interactions. But in this case, there wasn't any feeling like that, you know, he really seemed very sort of eager to get some of this stuff off of his chest, was very open about it. But you're right that certainly in the course of talking to other people for the book and going all the way back to the beginning of his life and his origins and his upbringing, there were always, I think everybody who got to know him felt like they knew parts of him. They were aware of certain things about him. They engaged with him in certain ways, but that they didn't somehow get all of him, that he withheld just certain aspects of his life, not necessarily secrets, but just engaged with people in certain ways, and other people didn't get to see the sort of full Robin. Nobody felt like they did.
On some level, this is true of most of us, isn't it? You know, we put a little bit of ourselves out into the world to our friends, our family, but, you know, we all have our own lives. And I think Robin, when you're a celebrity, that can be more difficult. But I think he valued that. My sense from your book is that he really valued his own time, his time on his own to kind of just ruminate and think about things.
I think that's definitely true. It was interesting, though, even to hear from, you know, people that he knew intimately, whether, you know, his own children or his wives, people who felt like, I mean, you know, his wife tells a story in the book about the very first time that she met him when he was tending bar at the Holy City Zoo in San Francisco, and he basically put on a French accent for her and pretended the whole night to be a Frenchman. And it wasn't until long into the night, and I think after she had dropped him off at his home, that she realized that this was all a put on. And I think, you know, it's on the one hand, it's just a story, but it's also, I think there's something kind of symbolic or significant about that all, on some level, Robin, I think, was always trying to keep his core and his, you know, his whoever he was at heart a little bit concealed from people, or just defending it preemptively from people, that he worried about, I think, being judged, that if he put himself out there honestly as himself and people rejected that he would find that very hurtful. So in some ways it was easier to shield himself this way.
Well, one of the things I was really struck by your book is just how dynamic a person he was, like based on your, you know, in interviews and your investigation. Like I want to try to capture as much of this as I can without giving away too much of the book, because I urge people to read this very compelling book. But can you talk a little bit about his upbringing? Because that surprised me, his relationship with his parents, and then the fact that, you know, he went to very seriously went, you know, studied acting. I think some of us know Robin as Oscar winner Robin Williams. It's not a surprise that he has this acting background. But then when he exploded, much like Steve Martin, like I had kind of neglected the fact that he was such a huge stand-up star. And I feel like a lot of his early upbringing and his acting and his relationship with his parents, I feel like that informed what he became and the serious side of him and the funny side of him. Can you capture that a little bit right now? Can you just sort of elaborate upon that?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think I mean, I think you're what you say is totally apt, and I think once you even understand the upbringing in his parents, that it's almost, it's like the Rosetta Stone. You sort of understand exactly why he sort of turned out the way that he did, because a lot of comedians, I think often we imagine them coming from, you know, hardship and upbringings where there was some kind of struggle. I mean, the classic example I always point to is somebody like Richard Pryor, who was literally raised in the brothels of Peoria, Illinois. And that was not Robin's experience at all, that his family was very wealthy and privileged. And, you know, his father worked primarily as an executive for Ford and, you know, did well by that. And the family had to travel a lot between Illinois and Michigan, depending on where the company needed him at the time.
Very nomadic. They moved around a lot.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you know, it was very hard, especially for as a kid. You know, Robin didn't put roots down for very long, was never in any one place for more than a couple of years. He often had friends wherever he went. But personally, I think he felt very lonely and isolated because on the one hand, his father was traveling quite a bit for work. He had a kind of reserved demeanor. He was a World War II veteran and, you know, the greatest generation. His mother was descended from, I mean, literal Southern aristocracy, that her great-grandfather had been both a senator and a governor of the state of Mississippi. And but she was very convivial, but also very into social functions and high society and activities that related to that. So she was often out on her own as well. Mm-hmm. And Robin would spend a lot of time at home, basically by himself in these large mansions with way more space than the family needed. In one mansion that they lived in outside of Detroit, he basically had the whole attic to himself, and he would just use it as a kind of staging ground for his toy soldiers and put on these massive battles and kind of create characters for his soldiers. So that, on the one hand, became a kind of a dry run for everything he would do in his comedy to develop voices and characters. But I think that feeling of solitude stayed with him. That you know, long after he left that house and well into his adult life, you know, still, as we talked about earlier, still kind of felt isolated from people and still kind of kept a certain at a remove from other people.
Yeah, and I mean, this led to a certain path he took. I mean, he ended up, when he was at school, he was often penniless, almost homeless. He seemed to be is that an accurate assessment?
I mean, you were talking earlier, I mean, you know, when there were three different colleges that he attended after high school, and you know, most famously, he was a student at Juilliard for 3 years and doing a kind of, you know, a traditional acting conservatory education. So at that point, he's in New York while his family is back in the Bay Area. And he's, you know, he's on scholarship there. And even though he has a family that he could get money from, he was very reluctant to do so. He was always kind of either borrowing money from other students or literally just like, you know, teachers and administrators would find him in the school building after hours, just kind of by himself. People would give him meals or lend him money. He had housing. He lived with people, but he lived a kind of bohemian existence for a time. I think that was, the 1 year he spent in high school in San Francisco, it was 1969 and the tail end of the Summer of Love. And that, you know, he definitely caught some of that.
Well, he was a very theatrical comedian. And I don't, like, I mean, just obsessed with Shakespeare and wanting to be taken seriously on some level. And I don't, like I mentioned his Academy Award victory, I suppose. And I mentioned, you mentioned Juilliard there. Can you capture just what an impact he actually had as a stand-up, as a comedian, as a comedic force? Because I think we kind of forget that, you know, outside of Jonathan Winters, Richard Pryor, these kinds of people, Robin Williams was idiosyncratic. He was a supernova. No one had really seen anyone like him. Is that fair to say?
I think so. That essentially, you know, it's funny because he kind of fell into stand-up almost by accident, that after coming back, after dropping out of Juilliard, coming back to San Francisco, and, you know, couldn't really sort of easily get into acting work there, but stand-up was having a resurgence in the city, and that was a path that he could take. And he really excelled at and helped pioneer a kind of stand-up that was very different from what people had seen before, where it used to be more kind of traditional button down, you know, a guy in a suit standing in front of a microphone telling you a kind of linear monologue. Of course, his style was nothing like that, that it wasn't necessarily narrative, and there didn't have to be a kind of internal logic to it, that it could really just jump from bit to bit or character to character with no transition, just at his whim, that if he got bored with a character or suddenly had a flash of inspiration and wanted to do something else, he would just jump from it to the next idea. And that's there were other people doing things sort of like that in San Francisco when he came into it, but certainly by the time he hit it big in Hollywood, and especially at the height of Mork and Mindy, you know, he became the sort of archetype of that style. And really after that, nobody else could do it without being perceived as a Robin Williams imitator.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of anyone. I mean, I think of Bobcat Goldthwait a little bit. I think of Maria Bamford a little bit. Like, I can't think of too many people that have sort of followed that path, even if they don't mean to. Like, I see Robin in those people. Do you see his influence sort of permeating the contemporary comedy world?
In some way, I think it's interesting. I mean, as much as he is admired, and as much as people sort of, celebrate him for what he accomplished, I don't think that there is, I don't think he had a lot of disciples in that way. I don't think you see his influence in contemporary comedy in quite that way right now. That doesn't mean that it's an ever-evolving art form. It doesn't mean it can't be sort of rediscovered, but I just because of the nature of what he did, it would be so hard. It was as much to do with the material as the kind of the pace that he performed it at. I think anybody who sort of tried to emulate it in that way or take inspiration from it, I think people would probably just dismiss it as copying him. It would be very hard.
Sure.
To do it and not, you know, to do it in your own way and to get out from under that perception of just being, ripping him off. But that doesn't mean it can't happen.
Well, let me put it another way. Like you say, there are a few disciples. Do you think his work as a comedian is as appreciated as it should be?
I don't know if it's about whether it's appreciated as it should be. I think there are a couple of sets of his, a couple of specials that are pretty exemplary that I think certainly stand the test of time. Others that, you know, maybe were enjoyable in their moment, but are maybe too sort of specific and haven't aged as well. But it's not necessarily about people taking inspiration from it. I think what's interesting about those shows is what it, you know, as you come to understand his life, what those shows are either saying about him, how they go hand in hand with things he was actually experiencing at the time that he's performing those routines, and also what he's holding back from people, how it really was, I think, over the span of his career, quite an effort on his part to really put himself out in front of an audience in a sincere and open way, that took him a while. And that, you know, even in those final sets, I mean, he and I talked about this when he was doing Weapons of Self-Destruction, that he still felt personally like he wasn't giving audiences everything that he could, and still kind of thinking to himself, well, how much more open and honest can I be with people?
Well, among the surprises in the book is the critical drubbing he tended to receive every time he did anything. He had this sort of surprising and remarkable success with Mork and Mindy, this TV show that meant a lot to people like me even. You know, I'm 40, so I'm just on the other side of... I watched it. I remember watching it. I remember it being on TV and being kind of intrigued by it, but probably didn't really process everything that was going on. And then the show petered out due to network meddling and whatnot, as you outline in the book. and, you know, maybe just taste changing and whatnot. But then he ended up in this stretch where until about 87 or so in Good Morning Vietnam, people didn't think he had it. People thought he was done. And from that point forward, it seemed like even with something like Good Will Hunting, which was, I thought, in my memory, was universally acclaimed, critics really went after him. And I assume this deeply affected him as a sensitive guy, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he definitely internalized a lot of the critical reviews that he received throughout his career. And I think, you know, a good artist, certainly a good Hollywood actor, I mean, I think they're all aware to a certain degree of how they're perceived and trying to position themselves accordingly. But I think in his case, you can safely say that he was probably too closely attuned to it at times, cared a little too much about that. And I mean, it did have an effect in the sense that, you know, in terms of what was made available to him, what work he could do or could get. And I think he also had a very good streak of both finding roles and also cultivating material for himself or surrounding himself with people who could help shape those roles. And part of why Good Morning Vietnam was such a success is that was a film that was essentially developed for him as something where he could be both improvisational at times in the sort of DJ booth scenes, but it also had a kind of quiet, dramatic aspect to it. And then going on from there to something like Dead Poets Society, and then movies like Awakenings and The Fisher King, and even into Aladdin, is really an incredible run. But you're right that there was a kind of, on his part, I think, a kind of vacillation between, you know, sometimes these very broad comedic roles and then the more sort of introspective, dramatic roles. And he often got dinged for, you know, playing these, what were, you know, dismissed sometimes as kind of treacly characters that were very sensitive and emotional. And they often appealed to him. I mean, that was true to who he was, and he could empathize with people like that. But I think at a certain point in his career, that balance got upset, that there were, you know, maybe too many roles in either extreme and none that were starting to find either critical success or commercial success. And that, you know, certainly he became aware that, you know, people weren't happy with the work that he was doing, or he began to feel like he was letting people down by not delivering at the sort of level that they knew he was capable of.
But Dave, do you find that critics mistrust dynamics, like mistrust change, mistrust an artist branching out as sort of some sort of betrayal of a core that they perceive? Like, this comedian thinks he's an actor. This serious actor thinks he can be in, I don't know, Flubber or whatever it was. Like, there seems to be, like, I mean, honestly, there are some bad, he made some bad choices.
Oh. Yeah,
for
yeah,
sure.
No, there's no question. I don't think, you know, it's certainly not, you know, it's not solely the fault of, you know, it's not simply that people didn't appreciate the work that he was doing. I think there are good sort of diamonds in the rough in the earlier part of his career. I think movies like Moscow on the Hudson and even a film that he made called Seize the Day, which is nothing to do with Dead Poets Society. It's the Saul Bellow novel.
Yeah.
Those are really quite good and maybe underappreciated. You're right that the later films that are dismissed as bad, yeah, some of them are genuinely bad.
He was going through divorces. He needed money. I mean, that's
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, I think when you operate certainly at the level that he did just commercially, then there is a kind of it does put an onus on you that you have to basically every year to 2 years you have to be in a kind of big studio movie with the paycheck that brings, and sometimes you're kind of stuck with the best. If this is the best thing that you can get at that pay grade, that's the movie you've got to make. And that eventually, you know, bit him one too many times. But I think you're right that the sort of the broader, you know, the sense that both sometimes audiences and critics weren't always willing to you know, look beyond the way that he was pigeonholed. Certainly the perception that, okay, he's a, you know, this is a comedian who is trying to be taken seriously, even though he didn't see himself that way, that perception certainly became calcified, and that was very hard for him to push back against.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Now, you've spoken to many, many people, obviously, for this book, and among them are heroes of mine like David Letterman. Did you get any deep revelations? I mean, they're obviously, I'm sure they're in the book, but was there anything that anyone sort of outside of his orbit or who knew him on some level but maybe didn't quite know him? Did anyone surprise you with anything they imparted to you?
I think they were all very interesting conversations. I mean, certainly somebody like Letterman, for example, who, you know, he and Robin were represented by the same managers at the start of their careers, the same managers who would represent both Robin and Billy Crystal pretty much all through their lives. Letterman came to L.A. More or less at the same time that Robin broke through. So, you know, they're both trying to, you know, make their bones as stand-ups at around the same time. And it was so interesting that I think Letterman was genuinely intimidated by Robin when he was first coming in the sense that Letterman felt like he was the kind of guy who just did a very kind of traditional stand-up routine. And he's seeing Robin come in with all this dynamism and energy and feeling like, if this is what stand-up is going to turn into, then I can't hack it. And Letterman even talked about almost this kind of masochistic, tendency on his own part to keep going back to Robin's shows and then coming out the other end and feeling like, I just can't do what this guy does, and kept going back and wanting to see more of it. And it was a really interesting thing. You know, they remained good friends, and Robin was always, you know, anytime he turned up on Letterman's late night shows, I mean, they were always fantastic appearances. So just an interesting relationship the two of them developed.
Now, you cover comedy and pop culture for the New York Times, that's correct?
That's right.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
And I will say, I mean, you've become on Twitter something of a comedic force yourself. I know you.
Well, you're nice to say.
You might blanch at this, but I think a lot of people feel that way. You're very funny. But I want to figure that out for a moment. How did you get into comedy and writing about comedy per se?
Well, I think that is just something that goes back to my own adolescence. I think I mean, I have very warm memories of things like, you know, certainly we were talking about Letterman before. I mean, watching his, you know, the end of his run on NBC, the start of his show on CBS, that's very vivid for me. Mm-hmm. The sort of late 80s, early 90s era of Saturday Night Live. So the Dana Carvey into Mike Myers years, those are very potent for me. Certainly the first few seasons of The Simpsons, all of that was very defining for me. Just things that, you know, just shows that I really treasured and felt like really spoke to me in a specific way at a certain time in my life. And then, you know, getting to write for The Times especially, but other publications as well, that it was just, you know, there was a lot of opportunity to write about the personalities on those programs, the developments that were taking place behind the scenes. They've just kind of gone hand in hand. It's certainly one of the great thrills of my job that I get to write about things that I think I'm genuinely interested in and care about or have a kind of just an internal feel for.
Well, it sounds like you and I have a similar trajectory in terms of cultural consumption, comedy consumption, except you're successful. No, I'm just kidding. kidding. So you, one of the things that I marvel at about your Twitter feed is, I assume at some point in your desktop, you must have a folder of just Simpsons related images that seem to be relevant for any occasion, because often, correct me if I'm wrong, that seems to be a go-to for you. You can seem to, whatever's going on in news in the world, you seem to be able to find a corollary on an episode of The Simpsons. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, it's more a reflection of how much time I still spend thinking about The Simpsons and how I think a lot of those bits and punchlines and set pieces from that show are just like, you know, at this point, like just encoded in my DNA. I've just like played them out in my mind so many times and watched those shows so often. But I think we're also living through a particular time where the sensibility of those shows and their underlying messages, I think, are especially relevant. So I guess it's all, you know, all that has just kind of dovetailed in a certain way that's, I guess, at least, you know, useful on social media and nowhere else.
Well, speaking of The Simpsons, there was an excerpt from your book about Robin Williams that sort of made the rounds. It was Pam Dauber talking about his behavior on the set as being kind of grabby and being a little overbearing. In modern terms, she sort of said, you know, he'd grab my body parts and I was okay with it. That's just how we got along. The Simpsons, too, one of the great barometers of society and
sure.
culture, is now being hammered for cultural insensitivity. Can you talk about that from your perspective? What's going on? Because I think comedy is in a strange spot on some level.
Yeah.
You know, I think on one level, everyone thinks they're funny, which is wrong. I think some people will try to put things across that are clearly offensive, but under the guise of a joke. And you know, we've got it now where a guy in the White House is attacking by name comedians. So I just wonder, as a someone who observes comedy and is seeing all of this stuff going on where satire is under attack for being insensitive, like, and like I say, Robin was among the people named in this, you know, posthumously. What do you make of what's going on?
Well, I think, respectfully, I think that these are maybe two different things. I think in the case of Robin and what Pam Dauber was talking about in that scenario, you know, that wasn't what was happening on camera, and it was behind the scenes, and it certainly isn't appropriate now, and it really shouldn't have been appropriate then. Even if I understand why, you know, she and Robin, of course, had a real friendship. They really almost had a kind of sibling-like relationship. They were about the same age. They had both grown up in Michigan, and so I understand why, you know, she might be somewhat forgiving of how he treated her in that sense. But I think what he was doing, there's still a kind of power dynamic that's taking place there. That he was a performer who was starting to come into his own stardom and realized it on some level. And the way that he treated her had something to do with, well, this is something I can do to you that you can't say no to because I'm the star of the show. And
yeah.
I don't think that, you know, I don't think you can really deny that. And it's certainly, you know, it doesn't seem to be systemic. I haven't heard from many other co-stars, for example, that also got treated the same way. But had it been reversed, if it were a female performer going around the show grabbing men's crotches, that would not have been tolerated.
Sure.
But I think what you're talking about with something like The Simpsons is, you know, that's a show that, God bless it, has, you know, been on the air for, you know, 25 plus years. And not that it doesn't still have something to say and isn't still relevant in a lot of ways, but it's also unprecedented that a show would be around that long. And it's inevitable that I think tastes change, our own understanding of what is appropriate or insensitive changes over time. And a show has to be able to, or any kind of institution has to be able to re-examine itself from time to time and with a critical eye and be willing to adapt and change. And it's ultimately the choice of the people in charge of it to make whatever decision they want to. But comedy is not immune to that. I think, you know, there's any number of examples you can point to of, you know, things that we thought were funny in a certain era that just haven't aged well, and things where we're seeing things that weren't appropriate or weren't you know, fair to audiences at the time that just don't we see it now and we kind of recoil at it.
Well, and do you want to speak to my point about comedy a bit more generally? This seems to be a whole, like, who can dish it, who can take it, like it's a joke, you're
sure.
not taking the joke, like, or
well, comedy of course has always been a place where, you know, the very nature of it, I think, encourages people to say things that you couldn't say in any other forum. But the audience also has a right to decide when it's, you know, when some kind of, you know, norm has been broached. And I think that's just a sort of an ongoing conversation we're having, often at a very high volume right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, I think as you said at the sort of the start of this train of thought, I mean, there's so many people participating in that sphere, whether it's performers or audience members or people who are audience members who think that they're performers. But so many people sort of, you know, operating in this arena right now that we have to confront that question on a daily, if not hourly basis of, you know, is this appropriate? Did it cross a line? Who gets to decide? It's just ongoing.
I can't think of another realm other than comedy that has been as affected by Twitter. Like, comedy and Twitter seem intertwined.
I think so. I mean, it's certainly one of the groups of people who I think helped popularize Twitter were the comedians. Comedians were one, you know, among the people who kind of colonized Twitter when it was still somewhat of a novelty. It was a place to promote yourself and to kind of, you know, throw out jokes that were maybe still in a kind of nascent stage, and kind of not to work out a whole routine, but just throw out one-liners, see if people respond to them. You get that kind of instant gratification of seeing a tweet take off if people really like it. So of course, you know, desperate narcissistic comedians are going to love that. So it makes sense that those are the kinds of among the kinds of people who would really take well and adapt to social media. But you're right; it also kind of creates this perception. It certainly lowers the bar for entry, not necessarily in a bad way, that other people who want to just throw out jokes all day and do it in a kind of a less risky way. There's no visible audience, as far as you can tell. It's not you standing on a stage talking to a live crowd and hearing nothing if a joke bombs. You can just press a button. If the joke doesn't do well, then you wait a little while and tweet another joke.
Yeah, I should walk back my comment about comedy being the most deeply affected sort of, I guess, cultural realm, because obviously politics is probably the main thing that happens on Twitter. But then again, comedy and politics seem to be really intertwining on Twitter. Some of my funniest comedians are primarily tweeting political, commentary. So it's fascinating.
I know. The comedians turn political, and now the politicians think that they're comedians.
Exactly, yes. It's very strange. It's a strange time. Well, back to this book, of course, this book, Robin. I want to talk about one of the major revelations of this book for me was about his final days.
Sure.
And the revelation, it's a spoiler alert. I want people to read this book, but can you talk a little bit about the perception of why Robin chose to end his life? What you think, or what I guess even medical practitioners think, was actually going on there?
Sure. I certainly, in the immediate aftermath of his suicide, and in the days, the immediate days following, I mean, there just wasn't a lot of tangible information. And I think it's understandable. It was a terrible shock and a tragedy to his family and to his loved ones, who in some ways also didn't know entirely what was going on. It was not easy for them, I think, or they weren't immediately ready in some ways to communicate with people and explain things. So I think in the vacuum of information, people came to their own conclusions and formed their own hypotheses. So people would think, well, he wasn't happy with his life or with his career, or he was having financial troubles, and so that's why he chose to take his own life. And then that seemed to be in some ways reinforced. About a week after his death, his widow put out a statement saying that he had recently been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And so I think a lot of people then sort of made the conclusion, well, you know, he knew that this disease was going to be debilitating. And so, again, it was a choice that he made to kill himself. And it wasn't until, you know, many months after his death, when his autopsy was completed, in his autopsy, they analyzed portions of his brain tissue and found evidence of what's called Lewy body disease, or Lewy body dementia, which is similar to Parkinson's in some way. And I mean, it's factually true that he was given a diagnosis of Parkinson's mm-hmm. while he was alive, but Lewy body it attacks not only the motor part of the brain, which is, you know, controls how you move and walk around, but it also attacks parts of the brain that have to do with just decision making, how you perceive and receive information and perceive stimuli. And so, you know, people who have it, they can have really terrible anxiety and paranoia. Some people have hallucinations. Often they kind of seem to they'll have periods where they seem to just sort of shut down in their own body, and that can go on for minutes or hours. And so people who knew him in those last weeks and months, I mean, they all retrospectively describe seeing him go through things that seem to correspond to the symptoms of that disease. But even though some of his friends, some feel retrospectively like they had interactions with him at the end of his life where they feel like he was trying to sort of settle accounts with them. Yeah. He was trying to say goodbye in some way. And it's possible. But it's also possible that, at the end he didn't fully know what he was doing, or in a sense know who he was. It could have, the police reports, for example, they searched his home computer. They didn't find, as you might in these cases, like Google searches of methods of how one might end their life, but kind of the evidence of an ideation. So it's hard to know. I understand why people, I think, in a situation like this, they would love the closure, the understanding of, well, he did this because of this, and that answers the question. And we may not ever totally know why he did it, whether it was something that he had, whether he consciously understood something was happening to him and he wanted to sort of prevent a further, debilitation, or whether it was just a terrible impulse that he acted on.
Yeah, it's a tragic, obviously a tragic end, and there are no real answers to an outcome like this one, and nothing really satisfying. You just have to accept it and move along. And I think, as I recall, one of his children has a very astute sort of assessment of that. Like, you just have to accept this, that this is what it is. There's nothing you can do to change it.
Yeah, I think it is. I think a lot of people, family as well as friends of his, who ask themselves and probably continue to do so, what is there something that I could have done differently? Could I have been there for him in some way? It's understandable that for people to feel some kind of lingering guilt. And I mean, the reality with this disease, with the Lewy body, is that it's progressive and degenerative. It's not curable. It's at this point, as far as I'm aware, there's no sort of advanced way even to sort of detect it before the symptoms of the disease are present. So, you can sort of, for people who have it, you can try to make their lives as comfortable as possible, but it's not, otherwise, it's not like something you can treat or delay, and people who have it experience it in all different ways.
Yeah. Well, we're not doctors, Dave. So I think, I mean, it's a, I appreciate your research here, and it is another of many revelatory aspects of this book. In conclusion, like, what do you ultimately hope people take away from this book about Robin? It feels like a really comprehensive and complete picture of a man. I assume that was your objective, to try to present his story as clearly as possible. But what do you hope readers take away from it?
I think you've summarized it very well, and I appreciate that. And I hope that what people gain is a kind of, an understanding of the totality of his life and career, how they were interwoven, and why the work that he did was so important to him. And also, I think the real pleasure and joy that he got out of entertaining other people, why that was so important to him, and really just a respect and a remembrance for the work that he did that was so good, and why we were all so impressed, and why we still sort of hold it dear.
Yeah, it's given me a new appreciation for him. I have to say, there are very few actors that I can think of who, whatever their role is, I'll want to see the film. I think my compulsion is, a director puts out a film, I'll go see that director's film. I don't know. Do you have that? Do you follow certain actors?
I think I used to. It's interesting because I think we're in an era now where that's, you know, I think films, certainly, you know, films for mass audiences are less about the performers or even the artists involved and more about the franchise, yeah, or the licensed character underneath it all. But occasionally it's harder. If you were to ask me right now to name my favorite actor, I would have to take a moment to think about it. I don't know if I, in terms of somebody working, I mean, there are tremendously talented people out there, but in terms of thinking about following a career in the way that I think I used to, certainly in my teens and 20s, I don't know if I approach cinema in quite the same way right now.
Yeah, me neither. I know there's, if a musician I like puts out a record, I'll check it out. If a comedian puts out a special, I'll check it out. But
right,
it's just an interesting relationship we've just developed with films. I don't know what's going on because I was I would go to movies all the time and I just don't go as much because they're overpriced and not as good as they used to be, if I may speak generally. But anyway, it's all this to say, it's renewed my appreciation of Robin Williams. It's a wonderful book. Where can people learn more about this book?
It is pretty much, I believe, anywhere that books are available to be purchased in Northern American locations and certainly on the internet.
Yeah, and people can, if they want to go online right now, henryholt.com, I believe, is a good destination, right?
Yeah, and the Macmillan.com, that's the sort of umbrella, the publisher that owns the Henry Holt imprint, Macmillan.com, I think will have it
right
as well.
And it's obviously on all your, people can find it on all. Did you do an Audible? Did you do an audiobook for this?
Yes, I only read the introduction, the prologue, and the epilogue, but there is an audio version on Audible and on audio CD.
Okay, cool. And what about you? What's next for you?
Well, I as I mentioned at the start, I have a son now who's 3. He was born during the writing and research process for this book, so I'm looking forward to spending a lot more time with him.
Okay, all right, that makes sense. And you'll just tend to your illustrious career as a New York Times writer and a Twitterer. Is that fair?
Yes.
Right. No books on the horizon at this point.
No. I'd like to keep it that way at least for a little while.
Okay. All right. And where can people learn more about you? I mentioned your Twitter.
That's the best. That's the best place for me. That's Twitter at D Itzkoff.
D Itzkoff. All right. Well, Dave, this was a tremendous pleasure to have you on this show and to talk about Robin. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and I wish you the best of luck with everything.
Thanks so much, and thanks for your interest in me and the book.
Special thanks again to Dave Itzkoff for being on this, the 402nd episode of Creative Control, to talk about Robin Williams and this great new book, Robin. Thank you, Dave. It means a lot. If you're new to Creative Control, it's part of the Entertainment One podcast network, and it's available on all iOS and Android platforms, and also on things like Spotify and YouTube and Audioboom as well. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for some reason, or if you wish to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. That's vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Vish Creative, or follow me at Vish Khanna. You can listen to a radio show version of Creative Control on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time, around the world at CFRU.ca, or on an actual radio at 93.3 FM if you're in or near Guelph. Also, please consider visiting patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. And if I can send you a t-shirt that bears the show's logo on it or something, let me know. Send me a note in Patreon, and I'll figure out if I can get you a gift of some kind. Thanks again to the in-kind support the show receives from people like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, Granddad's Donuts, and Planet of Sound. And thanks, too, to Jim Guthrie for letting me use the instrumental version of his song, The Rest Is Yet to Come, to end this show each week. Visit jimguthrie.org for more information about Jim. And last but not least, thank you for listening to this show, downloading episodes, reviewing and rating it positively and all those things, and just spreading the word about it. Please tell your friends about Creative Control. I want this show to be heard by your friends. You seem like a good person. What about your friends? Are they good? They probably would like this show. Tell them about the show, please. Okay? Thank you. That's it for me. I will talk to you very soon. Read this book. Dave Itzkoff's Robin Williams book is fantastic. Read this book. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.